happened, but it wasn't by some grand decree. It's like trying to explain why nobody saw it. Once everyone started to see that the world was much smaller than ever before, and over there wasn't so far anymore. What we did unto others washed up on our shore. The answer was hard to ignore. The end of war. The end of war.
Good evening and welcome to Peace Talk. I'm Rich Moniak, your host for tonight's program. Peace Talk is a production of K2 Radio's Focus on Community and is sponsored by the Juneau Chapter of Veterans for Peace. It's VFP's contribution to our community's conversation about war and peace and the important issues and questions they raise in our society and around the world. On tonight's program, we'll be talking to Jessica Goodell, an Iraq War vet who served in a Marine mortuary unit in 2004 and 5. Ms. Goodell is the author of Shaded Black, a memoir of her experiences in Iraq and with PTSD, the ghosts of war that followed her home. She is now studying psychology in a graduate school in New York State. Before we hear from Jessica, I'd like to give listeners a brief historical perspective on post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, as it's always referred to. War has always torn apart the psyche of many combat soldiers. It was called soldier's heart or nostalgia during the American Civil War, shell shock during World War I, and combat fatigue during World War II and the Korean War. PTSD followed the Vietnam War. The post in the name is just as it implies, an affliction that follows the soul long after the trauma has passed. It may explain why after the Civil War the number of men sentenced to prison leaped by 400%, about two-thirds being war veterans. It's why many Vietnam veterans still suffer today. And it wasn't part of the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders published by the American Psychiatric Association until 6 years after the Vietnam War ended. They weren't treated after coming home, and many never received treatment. And until veterans started coming home from Iraq with psychological problems, it wasn't part of the American consciousness. Now it is. And our guest tonight knows firsthand what it means. Welcome to the show, Jessica.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I'm sure PTSD wasn't one of your concerns when you enlisted. You know, in fact, I think the war wasn't even on the horizon since I believe you enlisted before 9/11. Is that right?
Yep, that's right.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about when you enlisted and why you chose to join the Marines?
I enlisted in 2001. And it really was just by chance that I happened to join the Marines. I was in my high school, and I was already enrolled at a college. In my family, that was what was expected of me, and that was the plan. And one day, a recruiter came into my classroom, and I asked him what he was doing there. And he said that he was there to speak to the young men about joining the military. And so I asked, you know, what about the young women? And so he said, well, why don't you come down to my office and talk about it? And it just happened to be a Marine recruiter. So it was really just by chance.
So what did you go into the Marines to do? I mean, you didn't join the infantry, and you certainly didn't imagine going into a mortuary affairs unit.
Right. When I went with the recruiter, he showed me a binder that was filled with all of the different MOSs, all of the different jobs that I could choose from. And he told me that I could choose from any of the jobs. And I remember pointing to a description of a tank crew, and I said, that's what I want to do. And he said, well, you can't do that. The Marines actually don't allow females to be in that MOS. And so I just made up my mind that I was going to pick the most masculine job that I could find, and that happened to be heavy equipment diesel mechanic. So that's what I actually went in the Marine Corps to do initially.
And where did that take you?
I graduated from school, and that was out of Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, and I was at the top of the class. And the few of us that were up at the top, we were allowed to choose our duty station, and so I chose Okinawa, Japan. And so I was in Okinawa, Japan for the next, for my first 2 years of the Marine Corps.
And this was all before 9/11?
Well, I enlisted August 2001, so just a month prior to 9/11.
And you went to Okinawa after 9/11 then? Or pretty close to the same time?
Yep.
So diesel mechanic is still not mortuary affairs. How did that come about?
Hey, well, I was in Okinawa during March 2003, which was when the Marines went into Iraq for the initial invasion of Iraq, Operation Iraqi Freedom. And when I returned stateside, I didn't get back stateside until very late 2003. And when I came back stateside, I was stationed in Twenty-Nine Palms in California, and the platoon that I had entered into had just gotten back from that first tour of duty. And so they had already been to Iraq. And so there was a lot of pressure. I felt pressure from other Marines and also from myself that in order to be a real Marine that I needed to go to Iraq. And so what ended up happening was a couple weeks later, the platoon sergeant said that they were sending Marines back over to Iraq, but that they already had all of the mechanics that they needed. So if we wanted to go to Iraq, we would need to volunteer for a different position. So a couple days later, platoon sergeant had this information again, and he said they need Marines for mortuary affairs, and my hand shot in the air.
And you had no idea what you were getting into, and you had no training for this. How much training did the Marines provide before you left for Iraq?
Well, the mortuary affairs platoon was consisted of Marines that had volunteered. And so the platoon, initially we went over with 18 Marines, and we were Marines from all different MOSs. We had Marines that were cooks, that were motor key drivers. We had Marines that were supply and admin and the NBC Marines. And so we all kind of gathered at Camp Pendleton, and then that's where they trained us for a couple weeks before we went over.
So you were being trained by medical professionals, I assume,
We were trained by other military personnel that had already been to Iraq, and they were kind of going over with us the paperwork that needed to be done and what we could expect at the different sites.
And what was that you could expect?
Well, in terms of paperwork, the paperwork that we initially were trained to fill out was we were trained to take fingerprints in the beginning, and so we would document fingerprints. We would also have a sheet that was to inventory everything that was on the Marine, so their blouse, their trousers, their boots, anything that came in on the Marine, we would inventory in an effort to make sure that everything that was on the remains made it back home to their families. We also had another document that we were to fill out that had an outline of a human body on it. And on the outline, we were instructed to mark down any tattoos or scars, any identifying marks of the remains. And if we were missing a piece of the remains, we were instructed to shade in that area black to show that we didn't have it. So that was mostly for the paperwork. And then in terms of collecting remains, I remember what they did. They had taken a bunch of raw meat and had scattered it in a field, and then they had trained us to flag the remains so that we could gather and collect all of the remains. And then they showed us how to, process that and put that into body bags and categorize it.
So you were working with raw meat. Did that give you any perception, any idea, any way to really prepare that you would be handling human remains?
It probably, I didn't know. You know, I was young, and I didn't know. I really didn't. It didn't sink in, you know, as to what we would actually be doing. And I still feel, even to this day, that regardless of the training, there's nothing that could have actually prepared us for what we were going to do.
No, I don't imagine it could. I think the whether it was raw meat, I mean, they certainly wouldn't want to train you with the real thing. It's more of a question. You sounded very, very committed to do this. Do you think if you had a sense of something more horrific to deal with, you might have changed your mind? Were you in a position to even reconsider?
You know, I think that they did their best to prepare us. But it's, you know, when the first remains come in, when the first body comes in, I mean, there really is nothing like it to prepare us for that. And I think it ended up working out for the best, the way it did with the training and ultimately when we got there, so.
So how long were you in Iraq before you started processing bodies?
We flew over from California. We flew into Kuwait, and we were in Kuwait for a couple weeks waiting for all of the gear and the equipment to make it into Kuwait. And then once all of our vehicles arrived, we formed a massive convoy, and we all convoyed into Iraq. Then once we were in Iraq, we were probably there again for another couple of weeks. And when we got there, we were stationed at Camp Takadum, and this was right when we were first establishing the base. So the Mortuary Affairs Platoon was assigned a bunker. It was an old hangar at an airfield, but there was nothing inside of it. So we spent the first couple of weeks running electrical wire, hooking up reefers, which are refrigerated units, and building different rooms, building different stations. So we did that for a couple weeks before we had our first body that we were to process.
Well, I'm sure that there's nothing that can take away the memory of the first few days when bodies started coming in. Did they come in a few at a time? Were you overwhelmed by them at any point in time?
The first body that we had come into our bunker was just one Marine, and that was not uncommon for it just to be one remain or one Marine. However, it was also not uncommon for us to get several Marines coming into our bunker, several remains. So sometimes, you know, it may be four remains or six remains that came into our bunker all at once. So really it just depended on the day.
And you mentioned in the training that you did the flagging, you know, mocked up remains, so to speak, out in fields. So I imagine, did you have to go out and collect bodies? Were there actions that occurred, battles that occurred where you knew there were fatalities, and was your unit the one called out to retrieve them?
Yes. It would always start with a phone call. We would be at the bunker, and the phone would ring, and it would be another unit saying that there's a Marine down, or there was just a firefight, and we're not sure if anyone's down, so stand by. So that would happen. And what we would do then was, after we got the phone call, everyone would come into the bunker, and we would prepare a convoy. And usually we would have a couple of vehicles, and we would be accompanied by the military police to help us provide security. And sometimes we had the EOD, the Explosive Ordnance Device Marines, who handle the IEDs. They would come with us too sometimes. And we would go to the site, and the first thing that we would do would be to set up security. And then we would often gather the remains from an explosion or a firefight, and we would bring them back to the bunker to process.
So those situations still could have been, the enemy could have still been there. You could have taken fire. You had said you set up security. Did the other platoons, the platoon that was out that called you in, did they stay by to keep you covered for you?
It depended on the situation. Often, if there was a convoy and one vehicle exploded, they may provide security until we get there, and then they would need to leave. And it just depended on if it turned into a firefight. One time we were called to a convoy, and we actually had to wait until the firefight ceased before we could go in to retrieve the remains. So, every situation just kind of varied.
So did you ever feel when you were retrieving remains, did you ever feel your life was possibly threatened?
Every day.
Every day.
It was pretty regular that our base received incoming, or, when you're out on a convoy, you hear the rounds flying. And it was certainly every time you leave the base, especially while we were over in Iraq, IEDs seem to be very popular at the moment. And so with those, you never know when something might go off.
So when you talk about picking up remains, and I mean, your book's called Shaded Black. You obviously that title comes from the impression those forms left on you on shading areas of bodies that were missing. But also, when I read your book, you talk a lot about some of the more serious the difficulty in piecing bodies back together, which says that they came back in multiple pieces. How much did you expect that to happen? Did you relate back to the training then? I mean, when you were just filling out forms, it would seem that you would be anticipating whole bodies, and then you weren't getting them. That would be awfully difficult to look at.
Right. It is difficult because even if we didn't know the Marines that came into our bunker or the remains, they were still Marines, and we were Marines. And it wasn't as though we were processing strangers. They were wearing our same uniform. They had the same watch on as us, or they had the same wallet as us. It's easy to see yourself in their position because it's another Marine, and they look like us. So that was really difficult processing because of that. I think that was one of the reasons. The other reason that I think was particularly difficult about processing is that so often the remains had come into our bunker as a result of an explosion. And when a vehicle explodes or when an IED explodes, everything that is near it explodes. And so it was often the case that we were scooping remains with our hands or picking up body parts and trying to place them together, trying to piece them into coherent holes to send home to their families.
Yeah, on the last program, I had come back from the Veterans for Peace Convention in August, where I listened to you talk down there, and I read from a chapter in your book on the last program as we talked about that convention. It was one of the more fascinating and sad presentations, one that left a definite impression on me. What the part that I read was the chapter you called Heads, and I think that was the hardest part for me when I read the book. It was just beyond belief that somebody could deal with that and then go on to the next day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is particularly difficult. And I think that we were able to continue on. Our platoon was very close, and we spent so much time together. You know, all of the men in our platoon, they all slept in the same tent. We all went to chow at the same time. We all went to work at the same time. And we were constantly with each other. And not only did the job need to be done, but I think that another large part of that was that we wanted to be there for each other. And so there was this desire to get up in the morning and go to work because you know that your platoon members need you.
So in the book, I believe there's a part two where you mentioned that this closeness of your own unit wasn't something that spread out, that the other units tended to avoid you. Is that can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Our platoon really stuck together, and that's demonstrated in like where we lived. So the majority of the people that lived at Camp TQ, they lived in what was called Tent City. So that was where all of the tents were that everyone lived together in. And the Mortuary Affairs tent was away from the general population. And with the female tent, there was me and there was another female in my platoon. We slept in the female tent with other females from different units. And it was my experience that, you know, I didn't really interact very much with the other Marines. I really kept to my platoon, and I think that that's true of my other platoon members as well. And I think that that's because, you know, we were doing the job that, you know, no one else wanted to think about. And as difficult as it was for our platoon to process the remains, the other Marines had to go to work as well. And, you know, if they knew what we were doing or if they were talking with us or interacting with us, I can only imagine that it would make their job harder. And so it seemed, at least to me, that, you know, we kind of had a distance between us and the other Marines that were on the base.
What was your impression? I mean, when you're that close to a unit and working with them every day, did you sense any of the other members of your unit struggling differently to process bodies and put them back together, and just the terrible nature of the work? Did you feel anybody else was struggling in a way that made them not want to be there and not want to even be in Iraq anymore?
I think that we were all struggling. It seemed very apparent that I don't think that any of us were really sleeping while we were there. I also don't think that any of us were really eating too much. And that comes from a couple different reasons. One reason is that we never knew when we would be called to go on a convoy or when remains might come into the bunker. And so it could very well be the case that we might be on a convoy for 2 days, come back, we're processing for the next 24 hours, and just as we go home to eat breakfast, we get called back in to go on another convoy. And so we would be working around the clock, often for days on end. Another reason is a lot of us had difficulty eating. And that was because the truck that was coming to our base to supply our base with food, actually while we were out there, there were several days in a row where the truck kept getting hit and was blowing up. And so our base was actually running out of food. And so we went down from 4 meals a day to 3 meals a day to 2 meals a day. And it got to the point where you would go to the chow hall for breakfast and they would have noodles, you know, or leftover vegetables, and that was it. So that definitely hindered our eating. And in addition to that, processing remains when there is an explosion, the remains burn, and it's essentially burned meat. And so if we're processing, eventually we have to go to the chow hall, or eventually we have to eat. And to go to the chow hall to get dinner or lunch and there's meat, there's a tendency not to want to eat. So I think that we were really all struggling in our own ways while we were out there.
So, but did you have even a small group where you started discussing the difficulties in a way that, that you might recognize looking back would have been helpful, the process, just the psychological effects, or did you all keep it in and more or less think about it the way a soldier would in combat, where you just have to do your job and get through it the next day and repress all this until another time?
Yeah, it was my experience with me and the Marines that I was with that we wouldn't talk about what we were doing because, you know, we had been on the convoy, we had been processing for days, and now that we're done doing that and we have a break, we don't want to talk about it. You know, we don't want to think about it. You know, I want to eat my dinner, you know, or I need to go to sleep. I don't want to think about this. So I think that there was a lot of, you know, putting it off and not dealing with it so that we could do it again the next day.
Yeah, and that's, you know, in the literature I've read, the books I've read by several psychologists who've been working with PTSD for years, they describe that as a self-defense mechanism, that just you need to do that to keep going. You don't have a choice. So it's perfectly understandable, but, you know, looking back, you know, it's basically setting the stages for what's known as post-traumatic stress, doesn't it seem?
Right. So, yeah, it does.
Well, I think what I'd like to do now is we'll take a little bit of a music break. Jessica, I've got a song that I accessed from your website that maybe you can introduce, since it was written apparently in relation to your book.
Yep. My friend George read my book, and he wrote this song based off of the book. So it's a direct representation.
And the song's title is?
The title is War.
I know that it's getting dark, but there are things I want to say. I try to shut the visions down, but they just won't go away. I'm hurting more than any war or battle could have done. I traded in my innocence and was repaid with a gun. Oh, I hear that sound. Lord, won't you get me back to that sacred ground? Hear that noise? I gotta get back to the field to help my boys. I grew up where the kids all played, chasing rainbows in the street. But now my boots are filled with sand and I'm burning in the heat. I find my mind goes wandering to that dark and fateful day. When the fire burned and the rain came down and I signed my life away. Oh, I hear that sound. The ringing in my ears from you not being round. Oh, I hear that noise. If I got another chance, maybe I would make a different choice. I'm not sure where it goes from here. I've never felt this way. I know that it's getting dark, even though it's early afternoon. The train conductor blows his whistle and he'll be here soon. I gave all that they asked of me, and sometimes I gave more. You tell them to remember that next time they start a war. I'm not sure what it is, but I think I'm going down. Oh, I hear that noise. Is that Jesus come a-calling, or the sound of an angel's voice? Don't you worry about me, Mama, I just hope I made you proud. Oh, I hear that noise. Oh, I hear that noise. Oh, I hear that noise. Oh.
Welcome back to Peace Talk on K2 in Juneau. I'm Rich Moniak, and tonight's show we have Jessica Cadell on. And Jessica is a veteran from the Iraq War who served in Marines Mortuary Unit. We just spent the first part of the show listening to Jessica describe some of her the daily activities and difficulties in working in a mortuary unit processing dead bodies of American soldiers. I'd like to go into the second part of the show and discuss more about post-traumatic stress. And I'm going to begin by reading something Jessica wrote in her book. At the end of one of the chapters, after she described a highly unusual and disturbing situation, she says, "There are events that happened in Iraq that I will never, ever forget. This is one of them. How could we possibly come to terms with an experience like this? And should we come to terms with it? If we were to, maybe that would mean that something was really wrong with us." So, Jessica, now now that you're back and you've had years to process, do you think you're coming to terms? Is that part of the healing process of overcoming post-traumatic stress?
I don't know. That's what I'm trying to do. And it's a real struggle. You know, trying to figure out why we were there or the role that I played. And those are really hard things to understand and come to terms with. But, I think that that's important in healing.
And your book is actually, as you describe your book in some of the introduction or the part written by John Hearn, who helped you write the book, you know, it's this described as, or you tell us the bit about how he allowed you to start to tell the story to him. And that's what became the book, was telling your story. In Ed Tick, who appeared on the Veterans for Peace Convention with you, as well as Jonathan Shea, another psychologist, both who have worked with PTSD for 30 years or more, described that storytelling as one of the major forces behind healing. When you began to write your book or to talk to John, were you realizing you were beginning to go through a process like this?
No, I didn't at all. I was really struggling making that transition from the Marine Corps to civilian life. John was my professor at the time, and I told him that I was a veteran and I was struggling. And he said, "Well, why don't you tell me what happened? You know, why don't you tell me everything that you can remember?" And I said, I can't. I don't have the memories. You know, at that point, all I had were the flashbacks. And he said, you know, why don't you just try and tell me everything? Tell me all the flashbacks. Tell me the little snippets that you have. And let's see if we can, you know, arrange this. And it was very painful. John would interview me every week for a couple hours or as long as I could go. Sometimes I could only go for, you know, half an hour. Other times I could talk for 2 hours. And it was very painful. I was often crying or I couldn't speak. And so I couldn't really see the, you know, the end of it, of what could come from it. So it's taken me a long time to be able to see that.
But even with talking with John, that began several years after you were back, correct?
Correct, yep.
And in your book, you lay out a lot of what a lot of people would consider very embarrassing personal stories about how you faltered, so to speak, as you came back from Iraq and traveled in the country and tried to find some place to fit in, I guess. Does it bother you to have those kind of, did it bother you thinking about it? Did you struggle with the idea of publishing so much of your personal story of what some people would consider, you know, some level of failure to not deal with it, even though it's not failure, but you put a lot out there.
Right. Well, I think it's important for people to know not only what's going on in Iraq, but also what's going on at home and when our veterans return. And, I feel as though I'm actually on a healing track now. So even though, it was difficult for me to get here now, I think that those struggles are important for people to be aware of so that we can learn from it. So it was difficult, but I think it can be beneficial from being published.
Well, I think it goes back to the idea of sharing your story and having a broader audience. Again, Ed Tick and Jonathan Shea both advocate for a larger community to hear the stories. In fact, when you talked about how painful it was, Ed Tech did an interview with the Sun magazine. The story's called Like Wandering Ghosts, and this was a couple of years ago. He says, ironically, the way to heal pain is by diving deeper into it. Most of the pain we are in is caused by our resistance to and denial of it. So John Hearn was really opening up a way for you to dive into that and get past the overcome the how you were stuck in the other aspects of your life, not being able to move on. Did he realize he was doing that?
I'm not sure. John is very wise, and he's also a sociology professor. So he had mentioned before the importance of being able to tell my story. And I think that initially the idea was to get it out on paper so that I could begin to process it. And I don't think really that either one of us had any idea how great of an impact that would have on my life.
So now you're studying psychology. Is that an offshoot, or is that something I believe you wanted to do before you went into the Marines?
Correct. I've always been interested in psychology, but now that I've been in the military, I've been to Iraq and back, and now that I'm healing from those wounds, I think that I might be able to have something to offer to the veterans who are also going through this, who are struggling getting on that healing track.
Well, there's a lot of veterans who obviously have suffered from PTSD from these wars, from the Vietnam War, a lot that don't seek treatment. Treatment for many, and I don't know if it was different for you being a woman, but, you know, in a men's world in the military, having to be tough, often implies denying any weaknesses, and PTSD has a stigmatism for a lot of people that it's a mental illness and it's a weakness. And do you think that your ability to tell your story will help other soldiers understand that it's okay, or do you think they'll look at you differently because you're a woman who experienced these things?
I'm sure that both will be the case. And I feel that really it takes strength to look at these issues. We all repress and deny feelings, but I think it's those of us that are the strong are the ones that are able to face their issues and sort through them, and that takes courage, and it's not easy. And so I hope that if people see that I've been able to do it with being a member of Mortuary Affairs, that there's hope for them too.
And hope for them. How many soldiers do you think are in need of help? And the statistics, obviously, the VA collects statistics of those who request it, or there's a survey. I think you talked about that both in your book and at the talks you gave. Was your impression that a lot of soldiers that come back don't answer the surveys correctly? That's what has been found in some of the research. And how effective do you think the surveys and the outbriefing was for you?
Well, what's difficult with the surveys that they give us to screen for PTSD is that often they give those tests and those surveys immediately after seeing combat or while we're still in theater. And the problem with that is that experiencing PTSD, when you're in the Marine Corps and you're with your friends and you have that immediate support and you have that routine and you have that mindset, the PTSD symptoms are, it seems to me, less likely to surface. Whereas it's, several months of being home or maybe years and you don't have your Marines with you. You know, you're not in the same mindset that you were in the Marine Corps. Well, you may be, but other people are not because you're in the civilian world now and you don't have that routine, you don't have that camaraderie, and then that's when those thoughts and those feelings start to surface. So I think that that's one issue with the administration of the PTSD checklists and surveys. Another thing that's difficult about those surveys is the questions that they ask, while they may be relevant in civilian life, are difficult to correlate to events in the military world. So, for example, when we were all finished with the Mortuary Affairs tour of duty, before we left Iraq, we all had to speak to a counselor. And so we all went into the counseling office as a platoon, and they gave us surveys. And then after we finished the surveys, we each spoke to a counselor individually, and I still remember the questions that they asked me. And the questions are, how are you sleeping? Well, I'm not sleeping because I'm going on convoys, and I'm not sleeping because I'm processing, for hours and days on end. I'm not sleeping because our base is getting bombed, so there's legitimate reasons why I'm not sleeping. Another question was, how are you eating? Well, again, our base is running out of food. I eat two meals a day, if that, because I'm processing all the time. And when I'm not processing, I'm not hungry. Like, I don't want to eat. I don't want to look at food. So I'm not eating. And then another question was, how's your libido? I'm in Iraq right now. I don't know what libido you're talking about. So while those might be legitimate questions to ask in the civilian world, they don't really apply, to a war zone or a combat zone. And so it's difficult to find data that shows that there's issues.
So those surveys were in Iraq. What happened when you got back to the States? Was there any follow-up to those? Did you have opportunities to seek it yourself, or did they come to you, asking more information to verify that, the survey, whatever you responded to, was either accurate or helpful to them, so they could know if you needed help?
Well, while I was in Iraq and I spoke to the counselor individually, after asking me the series of questions, he said, well, I recommend that when you get back to the States, you speak to someone. So when we got back to the States, I went into medical and I asked to speak to someone. They asked me the same survey, the same questions, and then they said, all right, I recommend that you see someone. And that was it. So I actually ended up going in, I would say 3 to 4 times. And every person that I went to go see said, all right, I recommend that you need to see someone. You need to set up an appointment. And I kept showing up, and I couldn't get an appointment. So there is some struggle. It's a struggle to get counseling while you're active duty. I'm not quite sure of the reasons why, but it is. And so what ended up happening for me is that I got out of the Marine Corps, and it was a long time before I noticed anything, because as a Marine, I'm trained not to complain. I'm trained to be tough. I'm trained to be suck it up, And it was a long time before I went into the VA. And then when I eventually did make it into the VA, I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, major depression, and substance abuse.
And they attributed all that, of course, to your service in Iraq.
Yeah, yep.
And what did they offer then?
Then they do offer counseling, and they offer the medication. And unfortunately, when I first went into the VA, I wasn't ready for that. I was struggling, as you can tell from the diagnoses, and I was moving constantly all around the country. And so I would go in for counseling, but I'd only stay for a couple of sessions before I ended up moving again. And so I didn't actually get any sort of long-term treatment.
And how long did you attempt treatment through the VA at all?
I've probably seen different counselors and VAs all over the United States a couple times. And it's been difficult. However, now I'm actually going to a vet center, and I've been with them. I'm going now.
A vet center, that's not the VA?
Correct.
Yeah, describe what you mean by vet center.
The vet center are local places that offer counseling to veterans. And what's unique about vet centers is that it is often veterans counseling veterans. What also is unique about them is that they do not share medical records. So they do not have access to VA records. The VA cannot get records from the vet center. Military branches cannot get records to the vet center. So any counseling or any services that are sought after in the vet center are strictly confidential and don't leave the center.
But the vet center seems to be much more effective and much more direct in attempting to help you.
For me, it has been. I've had some success in VAs as well, but for right now, I'm going to a vet center, and they also, not only do they have individual counseling, but they also have groups as well. So that's been helpful for me personally.
Well, one of the things that's also in your book that relates to somewhat to John Hearn's working with you and his non-veteran related capacity to help you tell your story, you've mentioned in your book, and my son served 3 tours in Iraq and 1 in Afghanistan. During one of his visits at home, he described something you did quite directly in your book about the support, the yellow ribbons on cars and the support of the American people that frustrated him in the sense that the thank you for your service and the yellow ribbons, people didn't really seem to be to want to listen to what he had to say. You know, what do you see the role of the American public in supporting the troops when they do come home, so that you know, you're not reliant on veterans organizations? I mean, you've got an individual that helped you tremendously already. But what about the rest of America? What do we need to do?
Well, I think it's really difficult for American civilians to actually support our troops. So I do think that it's great that they want to support our troops and that they're willing to proclaim it. However, the reality is that there's a disconnect between what they want to do and what they are doing. And to no fault, I don't think that it's, I think that they have really good intentions. I think that it's difficult for veterans returning home to make that connection to civilians. I guess my request would be for civilians, if they know military veterans, especially the ones who have gone overseas and have come home, to really stay connected to those veterans and to really stay on top of it, you know, to call the veteran. And when the veteran doesn't answer the phone, call again, you know, or to leave a message, because at least for me, returning home, it's been very difficult to connect to others, especially civilians. As much as they want to be there for me, it's hard for me to reach out. And so I guess I encourage civilians to be the ones to reach out to the veterans and to show their support directly.
Well, the Iraq War is very different than the Vietnam War. The vets that came home from the Vietnam War did not feel, by and large, welcome by the civilian population. The war wasn't popular. The war was lost. They struggled. Many, many veterans struggled with post-traumatic stress for years and years and still do. World War II was the last good war, as it's called, the war that had a purpose. Veterans came home from those wars and had, you know, a different dilemma. They and it's more similar to what I think veterans coming home right now are experiencing, in that the war was accepted, but people didn't want to hear the downside of the war because it was it people believed it had a noble purpose, and America seems to be have a love affair with hero stories, and they don't want to hear, you know, the downside, the soldiers struggling. That poses a difficulty, I would think, for soldiers to be able to talk to people if they don't want to hear such stories as you have to tell.
Yeah, I think that it's difficult for veterans because, yeah, we are kind of seen as in a light of being heroes. And so when we come back and we struggle, that makes it even more difficult to ask for help or to show someone that we're struggling, because we want to be that hero, I think. And so it's a strange disconnect within the veteran as well, you know, to be the image that everyone thinks that we are and to really be hurting inside.
Yeah, I would think that a lot of the parades, you know, the welcoming home celebrations, set that up. The celebration doesn't ask for, you know, a more solemn recognition of what you went through. I think, again, both Ed Tick and Jonathan Shea, who have been working with this for years, recommend and you know, try to encourage people to welcome soldiers home in a cleansing type ceremony, something that acknowledges that they served us, whatever killing happened, whatever the duty you did, for instance, was done for our country, whether we agreed with the war or not. You were a democracy, and you went and served for us. We didn't have to do that. So they recommend, you know, based upon traditional Native traditions, traditional cultures, a cleansing ceremony where we absolve the society absolves the warrior from his experiences. It seems like we have a long way to go to get to such a society.
Yeah, I think I've been very fortunate in that the book came out, because with the publishing of the book, I've met so many people that have been so supportive and so understanding, and I feel that through the book I was able to, you know, share my load, you know, and share my experience with others, and that I feel as though others have sort of taken that on, and I think that that's been a big part of the healing process.
Well, and it's a healing process. I mean, post-traumatic stress disorder, as we've been talking about it and as it's been written about, predominantly focuses on veterans and war, but it's a situation that applies to people who experience violence at home, whether it's repeated domestic violence or even, you know, somebody who's been the victim or sat in a horrific car accident and had their best friend die. So some of these techniques of healing apply to a large spectrum of society that does suffer through different types of psychological trauma.
Yeah.
And that's...
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
I think it's important for us to also, as families, to show our support and to try and reach out and to talk to the person who's experienced trauma. And really try and connect to them and really kind of take the lead on that.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us tonight, Jessica, especially since it's approaching midnight back there on the East Coast.
Yes.
And I wish you well with your book and more importantly with your recovery and your future being able to work with veterans and families to overcome these kinds of things.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
And I'd like to remind our listeners, this is KTOO in Juneau. We've been talking with Jessica Goodell about post-traumatic stress and her experiences as working in a mortuary unit in Iraq. Post-traumatic stress is something that we do have to learn to deal with as a society, as we've just talked about. A couple of books. Jessica's book is called Shaded Black. You can find that on the Internet quite easily. All you got to do is Google it, of course. Another book I've read and found fascinating is called War in the Soul by Ed Tick. And Jonathan Shea wrote a book called Achilles in Vietnam, which is one of the earlier books studying post-traumatic stress and the soldiers that suffered from it in Vietnam. And Ed Tick, if you want to find the interview that he did for The Sun, just Google Like Wandering Ghosts. And we're running out of time tonight, so I'd like to just thank you for tuning in. I want to thank Jeff Brown for being here to run the controls here. And with that, we'll be saying goodnight and wage peace.